The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Cosi.org.
Hey everybody, we got a great one today, you know, for a change, because one of my favorite writers, George Packer of The Atlantic, is my guest. George wrote a piece about the election, which was an eye-opener for me, the end of Democratic delusions, and he meant Democratic as in the Democratic Party. But one of the delusions that he writes about is the delusion that I had when people told pollsters that democracy was an issue for them. I assumed anyone who cared about democracy was voting for Harris because they were saying that democracy is at risk if Trump gets in. But it turns out a lot of Trump voters said democracy was an issue for them because they felt we don't have democracy now. At least that's what George says. George explained that they believe the elites control everything and Trump will restore democracy. And that some of the people who were saying democracy is an issue for them were Trump voters. So all throughout the fall, when I'd see that 40% of Americans say that democracy is an issue they care about, I thought, great, those are Harris voters. And I'm wondering, as I'm introducing this interview, do I sound like an idiot? This just shows how someone who is paying quite a bit of attention can miss something so basic. I think you'll enjoy this one. Finally, a thoughtful guest who can disabuse us of some of our Democratic delusions. George Packer is my guest. So a great one today, you know, for a change.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Cosi.org.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild. Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair. Every style, every home.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Analysis of Trump's victory and you draw the conclusion that we're now in the Trump era.
Well, as the piece says, there's been these periods in which a kind of political ideology dominated. And earlier in my life, it was sort of the tail end of the Roosevelt Republic, I call it, that went from the New Deal to like the 70s.
Till Reagan.
Yeah, and that was a time of growing social welfare for Americans, kind of a widening of rights and equality to groups that had been locked out through our history. And it kind of ran into the rocks of inflation and stagflation and the malaise of the 70s.
Right. Carter years and
exactly.
Reagan, are you better off than you were 4 years ago?
And Ronald Reagan and the Reagan Revolution, as it was called, really began a new period, I think. And it too lasted several decades. These are not just electoral cycles. These are periods. And Reagan's, I think, lasted until the financial crisis. And it was free markets and free trade, low taxes, deregulation. You know, there were changes. Bill Clinton came in, Barack Obama came in. But I think they were kind of playing within the same yard lines that Reagan had kind of staked out.
You know, you say that through our history, we've had like liberal and then conservative.
Yes.
Liberal and then conservative. So what was Clinton during that? Was he sort of in between?
He was in between, which is where he always seemed to feel most comfortable, triangulating and the new Democrats. But really, when he said the era of big government is over, that was a landmark for a Democrat.
It was shocking.
It was shocking. Actually. He was saying, yeah, you remember it. He was saying whatever our fathers and mothers thought the Democratic Party was about, it's no longer about. It's something else. We're not going to give up on Social Security and Medicare and equal rights for women and minorities, but we are going to accept that the libertarian ideology is sort of with us now, and we can't avoid it.
Well, when we went, Obama though got us, you know, healthcare.
He did
finally the Affordable Care Act, which was a big lift, and we made it. There were 60 of us in the Senate, and that's what it needed.
I remember well. I was sitting in the Senate gallery in the press rows, watching you guys take those votes, and it was a cliffhanger. And yeah, your victory, which you were the last of the 60, right?
To be right, yeah.
Yeah. It was dramatic.
And when I got there, Ted Kennedy was sick. So we really had 59 until Paul Kirk replaced him after he had died.
Right. And then came Scott Brown, and then Obama used, what's the name of that trick, that parliamentary?
It's reconciliation. Trick. I was in the damn Senate. I know reconciliation.
You know, I remember watching that vividly because I was also writing about the Senate at the time for The New Yorker. I wrote a long article about the Senate that was called The Empty Chamber because you guys never were around listening to each other except at key moments like on healthcare. And what I remember is silence. I couldn't quite hear what you were saying, but every now and then a laugh coming from Senator Franken. And that made it all across the gallery. There was no doubt you were there because I heard your laugh. And that punctuated all those dramatic maneuvers over healthcare.
Well, I have an easy laugh. It's easy to get me to laugh.
Yeah.
Comedians like me.
So let's say that healthcare was maybe the last act of the Roosevelt Republic, quite later. These things don't have neat beginnings and endings.
But what's interesting is you're saying, okay, there's been throughout our history, there's been liberal and then there's been conservative. Liberal trade back and forth. But you're saying that Trump is neither.
Right. He's neither. He doesn't want to reform the institutions and laws or to preserve the institutions and laws. He wants to destroy them because he believes, or he tells the public, that a bunch of corrupt elites and invaders have taken democracy away from the real Americans, the people. And the only way to get it back is by blowing things up and returning to some earlier era.
And I think people believe that. Well, obviously, because he won. But I'll quote from kind of an eye-opener that you wrote in his. Asked by pollsters if they're concerned about the state of democracy, these voters answer yes. Not because they fear its demise, but because it has already failed them. They don't think Trump will destroy democracy. He'll restore it to the people. Yikes.
And that is something that Democrats have a very hard time grasping.
Because we would see polls saying like 37% say democracy is one of the biggest issues in the thing. And we'd go, well, those are 37% votes for us because we're telling you that he's a threat to democracy. And that's dumb us, as opposed to half of those people are just MAGA people thinking that democracy has gone away and he's going to bring it back.
Exactly. It's a complete reordering of what it means.
That's just me saying what you wrote.
You said it better. You actually said it in fewer words and clearer words. So thank you. But yeah,
you're an elegant writer, I will say. You're fun to read.
So that's like the complete reordering of what Democrats went into this election believing was true and what Joe Biden probably won with in 2020, which was we will save democracy from this corrupt would-be authoritarian. And instead, it turned out that a lot of people interpreted that to mean we will save a system that has failed us. And that has not given us broad prosperity, that has not given our children a better life than we have, that has essentially become a corrupt system that only benefits the privileged elites.
And that's what they believe. And to a certain extent, it's hard not to believe that the fix is in and there is corruption and there is corruption at top. And the billionaires are that the fix is in with the billionaires.
And not just the billionaires, but the people one or two tiers below them, people like me who are college educated and work in a profession and make a good income and have their children on the path to the same thing and have kind of become a new aristocracy. We call ourselves meritocrats, but I think really it's become an aristocracy that's inherited from one generation to the next. And it is very hard now for people who don't go to college to break into. And that's part of the resentment that Trump has tapped.
What percentage of Americans you think that they are on the wrong side of this, that the establishment has failed them?
Yeah.
And is this particularly felt in rural areas that you visited after the Great Recession, right?
Yes. Oh, I spent a lot of time in Western North Carolina, in even an urban area like Youngstown, Ohio, where it was also felt because
steel
city that had been abandoned by the steel industry and by government. Yeah. And now I think it's pretty pervasive, other than in our big metropolises where, you know, people are computer programmers and media types and professors, and where the suburbs are kind of connected to the cities and to the economies of the cities. And essentially globalization and information have produced a lot of wealth. But once you get beyond that, you don't have to drive very far. You drive like 20 miles in any direction from a major city, you pretty quickly start seeing a certain, kind of decay.
And I think college education is a big part of it. I think people are so afraid of going to college and whether the debt that they incur will, whether they can deal with that.
I think that's right. But they also probably recognize that without a college degree, their economic prospects are a lot worse than they were two generations ago. And that too gives that feeling of we've been left behind. Other people have cut in front of us. People maybe who came to this country more recently have already cut in front of us and are doing better. And there's bound to be a certain amount of prejudice in that, but there's also a certain amount of just simple recognition that I'm not doing well, and that sort of the tide of history seems to be against me. And that's why Trump, by saying "Make America Great Again," is saying we're going to go backward to a time when you, the real Americans, were at the center of things. And that's why I call him a reactionary and why I call it the Trump reaction. It's not old-fashioned conservatism. It's something harsher, more bitter, more aggrieved. And we see it in a lot of countries right now. It's a kind of worldwide reaction against decades of globalization, which has created these winners and losers.
Is it also the economic crisis that we had, and then the pandemic?
Yeah.
And after the pandemic came this inflation. I'm convinced that, I mean, we'll go over the numbers in this election, but it's how much did Trump win the popular vote by?
Oh, 1%.
Yeah, 1%. So it was a close election.
By traditional standards, yes.
And if you think about everything that she had against her, that Harris had working against her, one was Biden ridiculously not taking himself out earlier,
yeah,
especially after the midterms. And then we would have had a process by someone, you know, that would have taken, you know, a couple of years instead of 104 days or whatever she had, 107.
That's right. I mean, even Hubert Humphrey in 1968 had 8 or 9 months after LBJ dropped out.
That's right. LBJ dropped out in March.
But it was similar. It was similar in that you could say the party elites installed Humphrey instead of your fellow Minnesotan Eugene McCarthy, and the party elites installed Harris. And in that way, the deck was stacked against her too, because the public already thinks that political parties are a game played by elites for their own benefit. So without the primary process, it seemed to confirm this kind of cynical view of party politics.
So considering that that was working against her, and I really do believe the inflation in middle of 2022 going up to 9.1%, you know, now inflation has gone down to 2 or 3%. That means it's still increasing 2 or 3% per year.
Right.
So that doesn't mean people really are kind of expecting the price to go down. Oh, we had the inflation, now prices should come down. I think Americans are very unhappy with that. I mean, duh. I think that was the margin in this. I think that, and she made a mistake or two. I think the politics of joy was not right. I think that was...
I was very skeptical when I started hearing about joy, because I'd been doing some reporting this year and I was finding something other than joy. And you're absolutely right about inflation, but I think Democrats took a long time to understand its potency.
Well, they called Bidenomics Bidenomics. That was not a brilliant thing to do.
Well, there was a real Bidenomics, and I actually thought it was a great economic policy, which was to bring back manufacturing, to bring jobs to.
Oh, he did that. And he's bringing in the CHIPS Act and
infrastructure.
Piece, the biggest infrastructure since Eisenhower. But I didn't see the benefit from that.
No.
We didn't see the political benefit from that.
No. And the reason is, first of all, it has kind of a long delay effect, like
sure,
infrastructure and factories that make microchips.
A bridge doesn't go up in a month.
Right. In fact, these days, a bridge takes about 10 years, it seems. The Golden Gate Bridge went up in a little more than a month, but it was pretty damn fast in the Depression. Now we take 10 years to build a bridge.
Why is that? Why? Just curiously, do you? No, you don't know. Why am I asking you that?
Well, I know a guy who has written a book. His name is Mark Dunkelman, and the book is called "Why Nothing Works." Published. And his argument is that the Democratic Party kind of became the party of lots of different interest groups that all had a stake in preventing things from happening, especially using environmental regulations and other kinds of regulatory tactics to stop things from being built. And so we have a housing shortage. We have bridges that take 10 years. We have no high-speed rail that was supposed to happen, et cetera, et cetera. So lots of things. Of course, the Republicans stopped high-speed rail as well. So let's put the blame where it belongs. Anyway, about inflation. So Bidenomics was a great idea. It just didn't take effect in time. They never claimed credit for it because Biden could not give a speech. And meanwhile, inflation was going.
Wait a minute. What do you mean Biden could not give a speech?
He couldn't talk. He just had no rhetorical force, and he stopped speaking eventually. I mean, he really rarely spoke publicly after the midterms. He kind of disappeared. I wrote a long piece about Phoenix for The Atlantic last summer.
About them baking out there?
Yeah, it was 115 degrees many days. I asked a local Democratic legislator, what do your constituents think of Biden? And she said, he never comes up. Like, they just don't mention him. He didn't exist for them. This was before he dropped out, just before he dropped out. So that was a problem. And meanwhile, inflation's going up, and it's going up faster than wages.
Well, that was not, that's not true now, but this is when what you're talking about.
During the key months of the campaign, yeah.
Well, actually, I think during the key months of the campaign, it wasn't going up, but it had been up. Again, it was like 9.1% in the middle of 22. And even if it comes down to 2 or 3%, it's still increasing by 2 or 3%. And people were expecting this thing, this to come down.
Yes.
And it's hard. Some prices on things have come down, but that's very rare. And people really, you know, really were mad at this. I mean, really, this is really, I think, a big part of this election was people mad at inflation.
But Al, I wonder if you agree with this. The Democratic Party has become more and more the party of the college educated, and the Republican Party has become more and more the party of the high school educated, that is to say the working class. And that's a complete reversal of most of
what
the 20th
it was.
Century. The college educated don't feel inflation the way people without college degrees who are making a wage rather than a salary do. And so I think Democrats underestimated the power of the issue until it was too late, because they didn't feel it themselves. Do you agree with that?
I do. I do. And I also believe that now that Trump has won, he is going to get his, and they have the Congress, that he is going to get his tax cut. That's going to be just like the one in 2017, which really goes to those at the top.
Yep. Yep.
So the people who are voting against Democrats because they take care of the wealthy don't realize that the Republicans, that is their main job.
And this has been the paradox, or whatever, the contradiction, for decades. And the way I explain it to myself is, if neither party is really able to improve the standard of living and the life prospects of the bottom 60%, let's say, then that bottom 60% is going to vote on who seems closest to them in terms of just values, culture, social issues, even language. And that's become more and more the Republican Party. So if the Democrats don't seem like they're really going to make your life better, which has been the promise, then what good are they?
And you point in the article to people who are in that income category, that, for example, Latino voters at 50%, almost 50%, which voted for Trump. What was the percentage on, say, McCain? when he voted. I know you. I don't. Not, I'm asking you to go back in your somewhere in your skull and find that fact.
I think that the last time it came anywhere close to that was George W. Bush in 2004, but that was way down in the 30s, I believe. And McCain was even lower, and Romney was even lower, which is why in 2012, after Romney lost, the Republican Party looked inward and said, we need to do something different in order to win these Latino voters, and minority voters in general. We're becoming a party of the old white people, and that means we're going to be extinct pretty soon. Well, Donald Trump came along and changed all the calculations because he was not saying what Romney had been saying and what McCain had been saying and Bush had been saying.
Well, what was he saying? Because he wasn't doing something to ease the tax burden on working class people.
He was appealing to grievances. He was saying that the problem is them, those Haitians in Springfield, Ohio, Mexicans who were coming across the border and committing crimes, and those elites who look down their noses at you and think they know better and want to tell you what you can say and how to live. And all of that became a pretty potent brew of a kind of hodgepodge of grievances that definitely appealed to people who were not just old white people. And this was the big mistake Democrats made after 2016. They thought it was all about racism, and therefore they were not prepared for the big swing in Latino and, to a lesser degree, Black voting.
Male Black voters. Male, what was it, a third?
Yeah, or a quarter to a third in 2022. Well, really starting in 20 and then in 24. And that is what put Trump over the top. Harris increased support of white voters and voters making over $100,000 over Biden. But the other categories, Black, Latino, and under $100,000, Trump did better. So that those are indicators, trajectories that any Democrat should be really worried about and should wonder, how do we let this happen? And how did we miss it when Trump won in 2016? How did we not see that this was coming?
Remember Barack Obama got in kind of an argument with some, I think, younger Black guys?
Yep.
So he knew what was going on. He saw it. Maybe didn't handle it right. I don't know.
Well, he attributed it to not liking the idea of a Black woman president, I think, or a woman president. Sexism. And that may be true. I don't know. Yeah, there are a lot of different individuals out there. You can't generalize, but I don't think it's a very effective way to persuade people. It's like hectoring them and telling them you're bad. You need to get better. You need to be better. It's like the basket of deplorables or clinging to guns and religion. It's a kind of way of speaking down, which Barack Obama didn't do as president. He spoke to us as fellow citizens. But every now and then he gets professorial, and it doesn't work politically, I don't think.
Well, that's that was a very small misstep.
Yes,
there.
It did not change the result.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with George Packer.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Cosi. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Cosi starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Cosi. wayside.org.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
I again think that inflation and economic, I think that they go hand in hand. The feeling that the elites are controlling things is that the elites are making more money than I am. They benefit from any decisions that are made in Congress and by the White House, and that I don't have a say in that.
I think that's a common feeling. I think it's not totally true. And let's remember that there are elites in Trump's camp, too.
Well, I think they have a few billionaires going to be on.
They're actually more elite financially than most of the elites in Harris's camp. They're billionaires. Silicon Valley has made its peace with Trump. A whole raft of tech moguls have run down to Mar-a-Lago since the election to try to.
Peter Thiel is J.D. Vance's sugar daddy.
And there's Mark Andreessen and of course, Musk. Elon Musk, the big who should not be forgotten. I think that they are salivating at the prospect of being brought into the White House in order to remake the government. They claim to want to make it more efficient. Maybe they do. But what do you want to bet that a more efficient government is a government that benefits them? They're going to be at the trough of the public coffers for the next 4 years.
And these are people who really don't know how the government works. So what they're trying to do is get rid of the deep state and use this for revenge and getting rid of the people who've been running the government and replacing them with people who will answer Donald Trump when they're asked who won the 2020 election.
As far as I can tell, Trump's two major goals in running again are retribution and enrichment.
Mm-hmm.
Neither of which has a whole lot to do with the public interest. And the people he's naming for his cabinet.
What do you think of the people he's been picking? It's frightening.
It's kind of frightening and almost like a entertainment spectacle. To try to imagine, for example, Al, in the piece that we're talking about that I wrote for The Atlantic, I wrote that the morning after the election on very little sleep, but had to wait a month for it to be published because it's in the print issue of The Atlantic. There's a lead.
Right. And is that called The Atlantic Monthly, the print issue?
It's still just The Atlantic. Although it's now going back to a monthly. We were at 10 issues a year for a long time, and now we're going back up to 12. So there's still hope for American.
I get it online, and that's why that's the best way to get The Atlantic.
Yeah, well, I love the print Atlantic. But anyway, the point is, I said the morning after the election that the opponents of Trump have to prevent Tulsi Gabbard from getting her hands on the nation's secrets, Elon Musk from getting his hands on the nation's coffers, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. from getting his hands on the nation's health. And it turns out I was just throwing out these names, and then they were tapped, and I thought, I was kind of imagining worst-case scenarios here. I failed to guess that Matt Gaetz would at least temporarily be named as our top law enforcement official. But that was beyond my, even my satirical imagination. And yeah, it's been quite a spectacle. And they all, and Kash Patel, who the Atlantic profiled a few months ago, seems to be headed for the FBI. This is nakedly about loyalty to Trump and the use of government for personal purposes, retribution and enrichment. That's all it is. And it's, it could not be clearer. And I think it will become clear to the public as the year unfolds.
You say in the article that Trump really doesn't have that much interest in making the ship run.
He doesn't. It's chaos and it's distraction. And especially with a second term, he doesn't have to think about even being popular enough to win re-election. So it, he's going to do whatever the hell he wants. I'm guessing he may try to create a legacy for his family, his children.
Or a daughter-in-law.
Maybe a daughter-in-law. It's going to become like autocracies, you know, in, God forbid, Syria and in Hungary and in a lot of countries where it goes from father to child. And it's going to be about enriching the Trump family. And it's going to be about punishing the Liz Cheneys and the Adam Schiffs.
And will Kash Patel, I mean, will we be actually trying those people for stuff?
That's a big question.
Isn't it?
Is our system of law capable of resisting this? If you've got Trump in the White House, Kash Patel at the FBI, Pam Bondi as the Attorney General, and a bunch of underlings they've appointed who are being appointed purely for their loyalty, then where is the guardrail? Like, what? Where's the U.S. attorney or the FBI field agent who's going to say, no, there's just not anything on this person, we're not going to do it, when they've been put there to do
it? It's going
to
be interesting to see how this works, is worked through, because there are going to be people who want to quit but won't quit because they want to be there to prevent what we're talking about.
I heard a lot of that in 2020. I wrote a piece for The Atlantic called How to Destroy a Government in 2020, just before the pandemic. And what I heard from people in the Justice Department and the State Department was, if Trump wins again in 2020, there will be a huge exodus from federal government. Will there be one in January? It's probably a little harder than it sounds because it's a decent job. It's secure. It's got benefits and pensions and even the illusion that, yeah, you can maybe be there to
help
prevent the worst. People always convince themselves of that. If I go, then it'll get worse, so I have to stick around. Anyway, we'll see how strong the guardrails are when there's nothing but rot at the top.
Again, it was like a 1% difference, and she had, what, 107 days to run? I think that's what it was. And she had every disadvantage in that respect, I think. And he also got was the subject of two assassination plots, and including one that actually hit him in the head, you could say. And what were the mistakes that she made?
I think being too careful, being afraid to give interviews, subject herself to difficult questions from the very beginning, and to maybe piss off a few Democratic constituencies.
Well, Michigan, of course, there was
that.
There was that. So how many of the Muslims in Michigan voted for Jill Stein?
I don't know, but it's pretty clear that Michigan was, I think, the second closest of the swing states after Wisconsin.
Yeah, Wisconsin was the closest.
Yeah. And the Arab American vote that went for Jill Stein or for Donald Trump or stayed home must have played a pretty big role. big role. And this was another mistake. Why didn't the party allow one Palestinian American to speak at the convention?
Yeah.
Would it have really hurt them to have a note of dissent at the podium? I don't think so. It would have shown a kind of generosity of spirit and openness to criticism and even to new policy ideas. And they couldn't bring themselves to do it. And this is...
And there was certainly a case there to be presented.
There is a case, absolutely a case. The larger problem this gets at, Al, is the Democratic Party has become this very risk-averse, kind of calcified, gerontocratic.
Gerontocratic? What is that?
Rule of the old. A party. Yeah.
Like from geriatric.
And status quo protecting. And that is not the way you're going to win a great many American voters, by saying we need to not make any major changes, but to keep things pretty much the way they are, because that's our democracy. I think she embodied that. She is a status quo establishment Democratic candidate who couldn't imagine saying anything that might go against exactly where the party establishment is.
Yeah, her proposals were money so you could buy your first house. I mean, they were attractive economic policies, weren't they?
They were good policies. Hillary Clinton had some good policies in 2016. I interviewed her just before the election, and we went over some of her economic policies, and they were, you could say they were populist, but A, no one knew about them.
Mm-hmm.
B, emotions are powerful and policies are less powerful. And in terms of emotion, I think neither Harris nor Clinton tapped into the way people were feeling about the country. Instead, they were giving them a menu of relatively small bore policies.
And then she did the thing which was describing the deplorables. She didn't mean that it was deplorable people. She meant that characteristic of deplorable. I really believe that. I really would have loved her to be the president.
I've always admired her. And I've interviewed her a few times and always came away admiring her more after interviewing her. She's a really impressive person. And you know, Al, we should just stop for a minute and say how unfair and awful a thing it is that two very impressive women have been defeated by a degenerate man twice.
Right.
It just says something that I don't like about the country that's happened. It doesn't mean we're hopeless misogynists. It just means there is something that isn't working yet. It isn't rising to meet history about us. I can't get over the unfairness of that.
Well, I just think that it's also how the candidate connects with people. And I'm sure there's a woman, not a Golda Meir, but somebody who just, you know, you just go, oh, I get it. This is someone I want to have leading my country. And I thought Hillary was that, frankly, but.
Maybe it was Gretchen Whitmer. You know, who knows? There are women who are incredibly successful and powerful in our politics in the Democratic Party, way more than the Republican Party, who should be given a chance. And they weren't given a chance this year, which is, as you were saying, was a big part of the problem.
Yeah. So what do we do going forward? I mean, what policies? Now, we're in the minority in both the House and the Senate, but we can be, if I'm in the Senate, I'm proposing stuff that maybe I can work with my Republican colleagues on, but I'm trying to figure out what that stuff is.
I think regulating out of control corporations, which does split the Republican Party to some extent, because they do have this populist wing that's come up lately, especially tech corporations, social media platforms. I think that's a very ripe target for Democrats. To go for, because it divides Trump's inner circle. It divides J.D. Vance from Elon Musk. And that's, Democrats should always be trying to to split them off.
You think we would have had this when we had the majority in the Senate and the House and Biden in there, that we could have addressed that kind of that stuff? And we had, the FTC chair.
Lina Khan.
Yeah, I thought more would come of that, but.
Well, it didn't. I mean, I think they did push some things. They brought lawsuits against Google and other big tech corporations. And we'll see if Trump goes with his base or his donors. My guess is donors talk. So that will give an opening, because people hate the control corporations have over their lives and the corruption between government and big business. And that should be where Democrats aim their shots, in my
opinion. And will he put on tariffs?
I doubt it.
Really?
I mean, Trump doesn't care about anything except himself. And if tariffs suddenly seem bad for Trump.
Well, just increase prices in the United States. I mean, it's just inflationary, right?
I don't know what he's going to do with tariffs. I don't know anything about tariffs. All I know is, no, I'm being honest. All I know is Trump doesn't give a damn about what he said 5 minutes ago, if what he's saying now seems like it's going to get him what he wants. And what he wants is not the good of the American people. It never has been.
Thanks for doing this, George.
Hope we get to do it again, Al.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.